You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, homelessness has gotten a lot of coverage in the media lately. Our guest makes the case that the way the media portrays homelessness can affect the way homeless people are treated, often for the worse. Now, new numbers are giving us a better picture of what the pandemic was like in schools. Across the state, chronic absenteeism, defined as missing more than 10% of school days, increased by about 4%, and student enrollment in public schools dropped by about 4.5%. No surprise, that was the height of the pandemic. But according to numbers for the following year, 2021 to 22, those high absence levels continued. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Parents, did your kids miss a lot of school during the early days of the pandemic? Is that still true now? If you work in schools, if you're a student in school, are you seeing more empty seats than you used to? What do you think has changed? What could bring kids back in? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Corinne Hess is a K-12 education reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Corey, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to situate this in time. Now, we've got a school year going on. Now, we don't have the data for this current school year. The pandemic breaks out in 2020. We've got the school year 2021 to 2022. Or 20 to 21, no surprise, absenteeism goes up. The hope, I think, was that in the more recent numbers, we'd see things go back to normal. That it sounds like, if I'm reading you right, Corey, that's not what happened.
No, in fact, unfortunately, it got worse.
Right. Can you talk about the changes, the trends we saw from that full-on pandemic year to the year, the hoped-for year of recovery?
Yeah, so before the pandemic, average attendance rates were hovering around 94%. Then the year after the pandemic, it went down to 93%. And now it's even lower at 91%, which means, you know, these percentages kind of are hard to wrap your head around. But what that means is Wisconsin students are missing nearly a month of school. And again, that was for last year, as you pointed out. We won't have the data for this school year until March of 2024, unfortunately.
And this wasn't the same everywhere. Milwaukee Public High School students only at school apparently 70% of the time in the last school year. Can you talk about some of the disparities you found when you looked at the numbers?
Yeah, there were a lot of disparities. So in looking at the numbers, the school districts that did the worst, like you pointed out, Milwaukee Public Schools, the absentee rate and chronic absenteeism was really bad. But also larger districts, you know, in Southeast Wisconsin, the larger urban school districts, there was a lot of absenteeism. Also Madison Metropolitan School District, but then also the smaller rural districts, you know, they also weren't good in northern Wisconsin. So there's just a lot of disparity. Also, statewide data showed that 58% of Black students were chronically absent and 44% of Native American students. That compares to 15% of white students.
You asked some people in your reporting, you know, possible ideas why. What kind of things did you hear about why the absenteeism not only persisted after the initial year of the pandemic, but got worse?
You know, some of the ideas that people had were just students' mental health just has not been the same since the pandemic. Other people thought that maybe just the need to be in school isn't as great. You know, people worked from home, studied from home. And so just the whole needing to be in school all the time, a lot of people don't think it's as necessary, unfortunately. And then somebody did say maybe there's too much emphasis on staying home if you are exposed to COVID. I'm not sure if that is true. But yeah, there's just been some different ideas.
And as we wrap up, Corey, this isn't just Wisconsin. You put this in a national perspective in your reporting. We are not alone here in these issues.
No, not at all. This is not a Wisconsin problem. It's a national problem. So there was a survey done not too long ago, and, you know, 72% of school districts that answered all said that they are facing the same thing, with students not going to school, but also teachers are more absent. And so teachers are calling in a lot more, too.
Corey, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That was WPR K through 12 education reporter Corey Hess talking about chronic student and teacher absenteeism during the pandemic. We're going to follow up on that conversation, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a kid in schools? Is the dividing line for you over whether you send your kid to school if they're a little bit sick? Is it different than it was, say, 3 years ago? Do you see more absences in your school, whether you're a parent, a student yourself, a teacher, or you work in a school? What are you seeing in your district? What do you think is causing that and this overall increase in absenteeism? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don Kramer joins us now, researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Don co-authored a report on student absenteeism in the 2020 through 2021 school year. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you, Rob, for having me today.
Your latest report on this, and this is something you've been following over time, Don, is on that, you know, the first full year after the pandemic outbreak. Can you take us through some of what struck you about the numbers you saw there?
Sure. We were looking at this for about 5-10 years, really concerned because chronic absenteeism was high at 10% even before the pandemic. And then looking at the pandemic years, it reached up to 16% for the state. And we were hoping that it was just going to be one blip based on the pandemic. But then looking at the data from the 2021-2022 year, it just kept going up to 22%.
I want to talk about the stakes a little bit, Don, here. It may seem obvious, but, you know, being at school, participating in classes, I assume is good for learning. Not being there is going to hurt students' progress. You're a former teacher yourself. Can you talk about what's at stake if kids aren't showing up at school as often?
Absolutely. That's the basic thing. You can't learn something if you're not there to hear what's going on. It's also interesting here because we thought oftentimes when we imagine someone not going to school, we think of like that high school kid, you know, skipping class. But when we looked at the data, it was also those elementary school students and those middle school students. We really saw the biggest increase when we looked at our data up through 21 of middle school students missing more school. Like that was the sharpest uptake, which we were surprised at.
We talked to Corey a little bit there about some of the disparities. You saw some big differences for different demographics around the state. What struck you from those early pandemic numbers?
Yeah, we weren't looking specifically at the students, but we were looking at the demographics of the school. Mm-hmm. And it did seem that there was a tie to schools with higher low-income, students from low-income houses tended to have higher absentee rates. Schools with higher non-white populations tend to have higher rates of chronic absenteeism, and schools with higher rates of students with disabilities also had higher rates of chronic absenteeism. So we don't know which is, if any of them are causing something else or if there's another factor causing all of these issues, but any of these by themselves usually is a concern, but all of them together definitely a bunch of issues for us to deal with.
I imagine you're probably crunching some of the numbers from that 21 to 22 report that came out and eagerly awaiting the current school year's numbers. But the fact that, you know, it was bad and then it's got actually worse in that following year. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's just incredible to see how much it's a statewide problem. You know, we looked at like the five largest districts in the state, and they had 20,000 additionally chronic absent students. But throughout the rest of the state, there was 30,000 additional chronically absent students in the school year. It's just incredible to think of like how many students that really is in addition to what was already happening.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jackie is with us in Marinette. Jackie, hi.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Jackie?
Well, so I had a thought about the absentees in the 2021 school year. You know, I think that it could somewhat be attributed to the masking regulations that were in place that year. You know, the kids didn't want to wear masks 8 hours a day, you know, the ones that did go. My own daughter, she was in first grade in 2020, so she was in second grade in 2020-21. And they offered virtual learning options that year as well. So we opted for her to do virtual learning the second semester of school, and during that winter holiday time when there would be a lot of exposure to germs. And, you know, I seen firsthand how that affected her mental health even at that young age. So I do think it was right on when someone previously said that mental health has not recovered. We ended up putting her in counseling in second grade.
Wow, Jackie, thank you so much for being willing to share that. I really appreciate it. Jackie giving us some insight, Don, into what might be going through the minds of a lot of parents as they considered in-person versus virtual, or virtual is not an option. Do we send the kid to school given they're worried about their health?
Yeah, absolutely. With the 21-22 year, I'm assuming many of the virtual options have gone away. So where that might have kept the absentee numbers down previously, 21-22 didn't really have as many virtual options.
And then Jackie also mentioned, and we'd heard this from Corey as well, Don, mental health concerns for kids. Now, this is not something that shows up in the data sources you're using, but do you have thoughts on that as a possible factor?
We definitely talk about it in the sense of relationships in the school. You know, how do we build those individual students, get them back into school? And a lot of that comes down to mental health also, just building that relationship between the teacher and the students, and just the students and the overall school culture. How much is it dealing with a relationship, building those back up? It's pretty easy to lose a relationship. It's definitely takes more work and more time to build that relationship back, which I think of mental health as part of that whole environment.
Jackie, thanks again for calling. Best to your daughter. We are talking to Wisconsin Policy Forum researcher Don Kramer about his report on student absenteeism in Wisconsin. Went up in the early days of the pandemic, not a big surprise, but continued to go up in the last school year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We're hearing the numbers. Do you have a story behind those numbers in your own family, in your own school or district? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Wisconsin Policy Forum researcher Don Kramer about student absenteeism in the schools. He and his organization have been following the numbers. They went, things got a little worse with chronic absenteeism among students in the early days of the pandemic, and then a year later got worse again. You can join in with your story, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Liz joins us now in Eau Claire. Liz, hi.
Hi there. Am I supposed to be on the radio?
You're on right now. Yep. Go for it.
Okay. Here's my question. What I'm wondering is, I am assuming that the data for absenteeism does not count people who are enrolled in virtual school, because that really can't be determined, the absenteeism.
Oh, interesting.
So,
Liz, thanks for the call. I think I get it, Don. If I attend school virtually, am I counted as, not absent? How did that fit into this data?
Virtual schools are included in the data. And if your public school was conducting classes virtually, they had some metric for how they would count someone as present or absent. Sometimes the student had to turn on their camera. Sometimes there was a roll call at a certain time of the day or at a certain time of the period. But yeah, if your classes were virtual, there was a mechanism for counting the student as present or absent. They are included.
I hope that answers your question, Liz. We'll go now to Pat in Eau Claire. Pat, hi.
Hi. My comment is, I'm a grandma, and I have a middle schooler and a high schooler grandchildren, and I have another middle schooler in California. And starting as soon as fall started this school year, viruses went around constantly, and my grandkids caught all of them and were extremely sick. My granddaughter in middle school had influenza between Thanksgiving and Christmas, And my grandson probably had the same thing, but he didn't go to the doctor. They missed about 15 days of school before Christmas. They were sick in bed. They did all of their homework from bed virtually. After Christmas, and they went back to school, they caught another virus that went around. They were bad colds. They were sick continually. My grandson in California experienced the same thing. And the school district sent a letter that my granddaughter had been gone 17 days, and they were going to report her to the county for being out of school too much. She had all her schoolwork done. She's an A student. And in February...
We don't have too much time left, but thank you so much for sharing that. Best to the health of all your grandkids. Wow. And Don, I wonder, you know, we had that early COVID year where kids were staying out of school to not spread COVID and not catching those colds and flus. And, well, it sounds like Pat's grandkids were unfortunately catching up on all of that. Do we think that could be one of the factors here?
Absolutely. And that's an interesting way to put it. We are catching up on all those viruses we didn't catch in the years when we were alone and masked up when we were together anyway. So, that's definitely an idea there. And just thinking of what she said, you know, these good students are sick. The chronic absenteeism rates don't care why you are out of school, and they don't distinguish with what kind of student you are. It's just you're either in the building or you are not in the building. Sorry, you're either attending maybe virtually or not, or you are not attending. And that's how they determine chronic absenteeism.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Mary now in Madison. Mary, hi.
Hi. I'm a mother of three from elementary to middle school. And I just want to say, since COVID, I have called them in more frequently and not said that they were sick, but called them in for a mental health day. And I have found support from their teachers in that. They provide stuff for them to do at home and think that that is important. And I think that your answer from your expert was a bit of a cop-out, because building relationships with teachers and the school, everybody is already overworked, overstressed. They need to put more social workers in schools, more aides. They need to focus more on mental health and put that as a priority, because teachers see that as a priority as well. If a kid is depressed or anxious, they're not going to learn. And so the day's wasted.
Mary, thank you so much for sharing your experience with your kids. And Don, we've talked about school. You and I have talked about school staffing before, efforts to bring in more emergency teachers. Mary's pointing to, there may not be the staff here to make that kind of connection, to do that kind of outreach to tackle this absenteeism problem.
Absolutely. And if we could get the funding to support all that staffing, I think a lot of people would support that idea. Building those relationships aren't just between the teachers, but also the social workers, the guidance counselors, all of that community of the school fosters the relationships that I was talking about.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Peter is with us now in Viroqua. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to share a story. When my son was a freshman, when COVID hit, so the school he was in at the time went virtual. And after his freshman year, he transferred to another school. So I saw his official transcripts, and they marked him down absent 26 days at the school he had been at during the first part of COVID. And I tried to get a straight answer out of the school as to how this happened, and was kind of dismissed, like, oh, it's no big deal if it's on his transcripts that he's missed school this much. And ultimately, he talked to one of his teachers, and that teacher, who had also failed him, was the one that marked him absent 26 times. And it was because he did not click the right button when he went on to take the virtual class. So I just wanted to mention this, is it's possible that some of the statistics, there might be a plus or minus, you know, deviance as to how accurate the statistics are. There's no doubt that there's more absence, but I wonder, under the stress of the pandemic, if things slip through the cracks like this, You know,
I gotcha, Peter. Don, we're just out of time, Peter. Thanks for calling in. Don, we were making stuff up as we went in a lot of cases. Did that throw off the data?
Yeah, and we actually talked about that in our report. Just because, especially in those early days of the pandemic, there were no clear guidelines on what constituted as an absence or actually, there was no definition of what a present student was, especially in a virtual situation. So we do talk about how this data that we're getting from the state, it's definitely not completely accurate, but it's definitely a preponderance of evidence to show that the data was in that direction, though, that chronic absenteeism did increase.
Peter, thanks a lot for that call. Don, as we wrap up, you know, the official public health emergency for COVID just ended. Schools clearly still feeling some of the fallout here. Leave us with some solutions and policies you're hoping we're going to see.
Yeah, we talk about policy a lot, and it's tough to legislate something that deals with absenteeism because so much of it is based on student by student and dealing with the issues that happen individually. Whatever is going to work for the high school students is probably not going to work for the middle school and the elementary school students too. It's a really easy answer to say that we wish there were more funding to provide personnel that could reach out to the absent students. But I think individual districts really have to think about how they're going to work with the individual problems or issues that are happening locally.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Don Kramer, researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He talked to us about large number of students missing school starting at the beginning of the pandemic and not necessarily getting any better, according at least to the latest data. Love to hear from you if you, your school district, your family has tackled this problem and maybe found solutions that you'd want to share with the world. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Did your district find a way to reach out and help solve some of the problems that led to higher chronic absenteeism? Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a new book looks at a long-term effort to clean up the environment in northeastern Wisconsin. Meet the authors of Paper Valley, The Fight for the Fox River Cleanup. If you were part of that story yourself, I'm sure Kate and her guests would love to hear from you tomorrow as well. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, a legal and political fight over student loan forgiveness has left millions in limbo. 1A's series Life and Debt looks at its impact and the plan to restart federal student loan repayments. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, Daniel Penny is facing charges of second-degree manslaughter after killing Jordan Neely on a New York City subway earlier this month. Police say Neely, who was homeless, was behaving erratically but hadn't assaulted anyone before Penny put him in a chokehold and ultimately killed him. In addition to arguments about the specifics of the incident, the event has drawn attention to wider issues of homelessness and the way homeless people are treated, viewed, and talked about. Our next guest says that media portrayals of homelessness in our news and our popular culture can influence our real-world behavior towards unhoused people, even to the point of violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you usually see homelessness depicted in the media? Where do you think we could do better? Have you yourself experienced homelessness at some point in your life? How did you see people seeing you differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Whitney Gent is an assistant professor of rhetoric and civic engagement at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. She got her doctorate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her research focuses on rhetorics of poverty and homelessness. So welcome back to Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Now, whether it's in the media or our day-to-day lives, where do you see people getting it wrong when it comes to the way we talk about homelessness?
Mm-hmm. Well, whether we're talking about entertainment media or we are talking about news media, the representations of homelessness that we see are of homeless people as criminals, homeless people as folks who have made bad decisions to get themselves to the places where they are. Oftentimes an immediate assumption that is made about homeless people based on political rhetoric and media rhetoric is that they are mentally ill or dealing with issues related to addiction, which is not necessarily the case. All of these things collectively give media viewers and just plain citizens who are involved in their communities ideas about homelessness that make homeless people feel like a threat.
And it seems like there's, I see two different approaches to talk about homelessness. One is to talk about a social problem of homelessness as the issue. Another is to talk about the presence where they might not be wanted of homeless people as the problem. Can you talk about that distinction? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. Very often, cities don't know what to do about homelessness, and they try to respond to community members' concerns about public safety or concerns about how a city might appear to tourists, business concerns, et cetera, with actions that simply move homeless people around or criminalize behaviors that would be absolutely normal for someone who is not homeless. So, for example, cities institute laws against sitting on sidewalks in particular spaces to discourage homeless people from being in downtown areas. Madison was experimenting with laws like this for quite a while. I don't know whether it is still the case. Laws like this and other laws that make it illegal to share food with homeless people in public places, et cetera, are all tactics to manage where homeless people are in a city. These give off the message to the general public that homeless people are undesirable, that they are unsightly, that there is something wrong with them being in public spaces. And that continues to feed these narratives that homeless people are unsafe or that they should not be around housed people. That's very different than crafting policy that actually gives housing to homeless people. And very often, cities are not doing both. They are choosing these policies that criminalize homelessness rather than investing in infrastructure that will keep people housed and rehouse people who have become homeless.
We are talking about how we talk about homelessness and people who are homeless with Whitney Gent, University of Nebraska, Omaha, Assistant Professor of Rhetoric and Civic Engagement. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you see your own local community working on problems related to homelessness? Do you think it's a positive or negative the way that the issue is being handled? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's get into some of the different places where we might see rhetoric surrounding homelessness. And let's start with the news media, which I know covers a lot of ground. But what kind of things do you see in reporting about homelessness that concerns you?
Well, let's talk specifically about this case with the murder of Jordan Neely on the subway in New York. If you look at different forms of media framing around this story, it's very politically driven, right? So if you look at CNN, you see a story that tells you that Daniel Penny, the 24-year-old ex-Marine who put Neely in a chokehold, ought to be convicted, right? If you are reading the Fox News write-up of this story, you see Neely, this homeless man, portrayed in terms of his rap sheet, all of the things that he may have done incorrectly over time or illegally over time. And you literally get a beach shot of shirtless alleged murderer Daniel Penny in that same story. So we have a really clear villain and savior in this Fox News story. And the savior is the alleged murderer of this man on the subway. So we're seeing very politicized racialized representation here. We are seeing the portrayal of a homeless person, again, as a criminal in this Fox News story. Neely, yes, committed a number of infractions in the city of New York. Daniel Penny, encountering him on the subway, however, could have had absolutely no idea that that was the case, right? Neely was behaving erratically on the subway, but Penny may have genuinely believed that he was protecting others, or that his chokehold of Neely was in self-defense. But he likely believed that not because he knew Neely, but because of the messages that he has likely consumed about the dangers of Black men, of homeless people, of people with mental illness through news media coverage and entertainment media coverage and the political messages of the city all around him.
And that gets,
so we're seeing real impacts.
And I think that gets to part of your core concern, that the way the media and pop culture portrays homeless people might then influence the way people interact with people who are homeless in real life.
Absolutely. Yes.
We're talking to Whitney Gent, assistant professor of rhetoric and civic engagement at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Her research focuses on rhetorics of poverty and homelessness. We're talking about the ways that homelessness is portrayed in the news and popular culture, how that influences our opinions of people who are homeless. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see when you watch the news or a TV show, a movie, and homelessness is part of the story? How do you see homeless people represented there? Do you see a lot of homelessness in your community? How does your community handle that as an issue, or does it ignore it? If you've experienced homelessness yourself, how did people treat you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Whitney Gent, assistant professor of rhetoric and civic engagement at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Excuse me. She studies rhetorics of poverty and homelessness. A man who was homeless was killed on a New York City subway by a fellow passenger earlier this month. And we're talking with our guest about how our conversations around homelessness impact our real-world actions. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hey, Rob. So it's a little bit rough, but about 8 years ago, I ended up homeless. I was married. My wife of 10 years has been a stay-at-home mom for most of it. Getting divorced, the divorce and, you know, the fighting for the kids cost over $130,000. And I ended up homeless. Even though I had a good job, I was making decent money doing manufacturing. I'd work 4 days on, 3 days off, night shifts. And on the other three, when I was off, I had to stay on the same schedule. So I'd stay up at night and I'd walk around in the streets of Milwaukee because I had a car. And I'd pick up scrap metal and sort it in the back of my car and then take it in cash the next morning so that I could earn some extra money. And the cops would stop me lots of times, even though I had, you know, like bags, you know, so I'm picking up stuff in the street doing a public service. And I never was written a ticket, but it's just, you know, it's just astonishing to me because I was not on drugs. I was just, it was just a series of bad circumstances and I couldn't afford a place to live and pay child support and my attorney and, you know, alimony and all the rest of it.
And Marcus, when you think back on it, and thank you so much for being willing to share the story with us. I mean, do you think that you were what people thought about when they thought about a homeless person?
I don't know. I didn't feel seen most of the time just because, you know, like my clothes, my outer clothes were, my winter jacket was a little bit dirtier just because I'm picking up scrap metal. And people would just walk past me where, you know, I'd even say hi to them. I'm a pretty friendly person. And yeah, lots of times I got no response. So they pretend like they didn't hear me. And so it's a very strange and enlightening situation, sir.
Marcus, thank you so much again for being able to share, willing to share that with us. Professor Gent, I don't know, when we start to talk to people who are homeless, some of the stereotypes might break down. The stories might not be what we expect.
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. And I appreciate Marcus sharing his story about feeling invisible, because my experience is that that is often the case with people who are living homeless. And I think that that is a further boon to the argument that I'm making about media representation. People have a tendency to ignore or not really see those who are experiencing homelessness around them, but to absorb instead these media representations of people experiencing homelessness that may not actually be accurate and that peddle in the kinds of damaging stereotypes that I have already mentioned. One way that we have seen this is a shift over time in Hollywood representations of homelessness. In the late 80s, early 90s, most of the films about homelessness actually were comedies that made fun of people who weren't trying to help people experiencing homelessness. As time has gone on, we have seen a shift towards seeing more depictions of homeless people as useless or as criminals. We have also seen a shift towards not comedy, but the sort of gritty drama where people overcome their homelessness through the help of someone who is housed, a sort of savior narrative. And very often it is a Black person experiencing homelessness who is helped out of that homelessness by someone who is white and housed. So the stories that we are seeing on our screens don't necessarily match the stories of the people who are actually in front of us experiencing homelessness when we pass them by, like Marcus is depicting.
Thanks for that call, Marcus. Nick joins us now in Green Bay. Nick, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Nick?
We're homeless right now. We're staying in a hotel. I got hurt at work and I got fired, but they gave me a $5,000 to leave, and that was my only recourse. And we're homeless now because I lost everything because of the work accident. The only thing that I'm hoping for is that workers' comp is going to come in. Hopefully I get a nice settlement where we can buy our own house. But yeah, right now we're just living out of a hotel, and the people at the hotel are super nice. They like help us out as much as they can possibly, but it's just frustrating because my wife and I both work, but we don't make enough money to pay rent. We got three kids, so it's just really hard.
Nick, apart from hoping workers' comp comes through, like, is there something that you think, hey, this is something that could help us out, help connect us with a place to live, a permanent place to live that we can afford?
Nothing that I've found so far. And thank God my mom-in-law, because she's putting the hotel on her credit card. And I mean, we're just buying our time. We're working. We both work full time, but it just rent is ridiculous.
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. I really appreciate it. Best to you and your family, and I hope you get through this soon. Professor Gent, can you talk about, turning the conversation toward policies, solutions that might help people in Nick's situation?
Absolutely. You know, first of all, I want to say that the situations that Marcus and Nick have just shared with us are not unusual in the population of people who have experienced homelessness. That, you know, earlier I was talking about the stereotypes or assumptions that everyone who's experiencing homelessness is either addicted to something or has made terrible choices that cause them to end up on the street or mentally ill. In neither of these cases do we find those things to be true. The assumptions that people make about homelessness are often obstacles to policymaking and often obstacles to the development of enough public will to cause politicians to pay attention to homelessness. So most of the time when cities are working to ameliorate issues related to homelessness, they are doing so out of a concern from a business community that having homeless people out in front of their storefronts will cause a decline in their business. This leads to the kind of policymaking that we were talking about before, where homeless people get shuffled around. If we have the political will to motivate politicians to create housing, to better understand why people are experiencing homelessness, then we are actually addressing the source of the problem related to homelessness, rather than peddling in stereotypes, or rather than addressing the problem for business owners, as opposed to for the people who are experiencing homelessness themselves.
Thanks again, Nick, for sharing your story with us. Talking to Whitney Gent from the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Studies rhetoric and civic engagement there. Looking at talking about the way we talk about homelessness and homeless people in the United States. Back to your calls now with Jan in Illinois. Jan, hello.
Hey, hi. The part that I came into the radio station talking about the killing in the subway, this homeless man. And in that instance, to me, homeless has nothing to do with it. The circumstances at the time was a violent, angry, scary individual threatening people, and people took it in their own hands to take him down because other scary, violent people have done this before. And so using homelessness in that case to, like, make him appear to be, oh, poor homeless man, and here we're mean to him, is baloney. I mean, it just is twisting the facts. And now you've made homelessness as a bad, you know, bad, awful people are all homeless. No, this guy, number one, was a career criminal. And then number two, he was violent at the time. And nobody in the subway knows anything about this other background issues. So, you know, it's like quit dragging homeless into those kind of situations. But
Jan, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Professor Gett, Jan saying maybe in this case homelessness, the homeless status here shouldn't be at the center of the story. What do you think?
I think that we can't remove it from the center of the story, Rob. I disagree with Jan about the order of things. I believe that Daniel Penny saw Jordan Neely as a threat because of the ways that he has seen homelessness represented. Neely was not violent. He was speaking loudly. He was yelling and he was making threats. But there's no evidence that he exhibited any actually violent behavior. And even if he had exhibited actually violent behavior, I would argue that there was no need for that to result in his death. That the perception of Neely as violent comes from his identity as a homeless man and the ways that that all gets tied up in the New York subway, in his identity as a Black man, in mental illness, etc. So while I hear what Jan is saying and I hear her concern for not demonizing homeless people, I think that we cannot quite so easily separate those things.
Jan, thanks a lot for calling in. Professor Gent, could you steer us toward places where you think there are accurate or helpful depictions of homelessness, whether it's in media coverage or in your work looking at popular culture?
Yeah, I actually would point people toward the YouTube channel or website called Invisible People, which contains a series of interviews with people who are or have experienced homelessness. This allows our listeners to experience stories firsthand as opposed to mediated representations where people have crafted stories that they think will be appealing to Hollywood audiences or the audiences who are streaming whatever content is created. It allows people to tell their own stories instead of having those stories shaped for audiences. And I think it's really crucial that we listen to stories from those perspectives.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Whitney Gent is an assistant professor of rhetoric and civic engagement at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Her research focuses on rhetoric about poverty and homelessness. She joined us for a conversation about how we talk about homelessness and how that translates into real-world actions and sometimes policies. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, new legislation here in Wisconsin aims to tackle the PFAS problem in our water supply for communities around the state. We'll hear from one of the bill's sponsors and look at the wider problem. William Shakespeare's enduring popularity has led to a lot of theories, sometimes conspiracy theories, about who actually created his plays. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies. Plus, it's Friday. That means it's going to be Food Friday. We're going to get some great baking advice from a psychotherapist who also happens to be a master baker. We'll get actual practical advice in the kitchen, plus learn about the mental health benefits of baking bread and other baked goods. You can join in with your own stories right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.